If you want to get ahead in the tech field, there are skills you won't learn in the classroom.
Women present themselves with less confidence, you know, rather than walking into a room and saying, hey, here's what I think, and here's why I think my company's going to succeed.
We'll talk with a woman whose blog has become a business advising workers and entrepreneurs in the tech field. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. A recent science test showing that American girls are lagging behind boys has brought women in science back into the national conversation. More than 50 years ago, one group of engineers argued that training girls in scientific fields is not just about equality, it's about the fate of our nation. Allison Quance has this story.
The first real surge of women engineers came with World War II. Laura Puaca, an historian at Christopher Newport University, studies that moment in history.
Oftentimes when we think of women in World War II, we think of Rosie the Riveter. This is sort of like her cousin, Edna the Engineer.
Today, women in overalls, women in war jobs, are to be found throughout the length and breadth of America.
Puaca says that during World War II, more than 250,000 women trained for jobs as engineers' aides. But in the post-war period, women engineers and scientists faced a hostile environment. So they fought back.
In response to this, these women's engineering societies spring up in the immediate post-World War II period. And essentially, these women are coming together in ways that they hadn't come together before to protect the gains that they had made during World War II and to provide each other support.
They formed the Society of Women Engineers.
Throughout the 1950s, they held meetings where they would counsel each other, they would give each other career advice. They would also try to recruit and encourage young women. They would participate in career days and try to provide young women with female role models in the field.
But in the era of McCarthyism, all this talk about women in the workplace could be seen as subversive. So they argued that women engineers were necessary if the U.S. wanted to beat Russia.
They did take such care in crafting this public image as not a feminist organization, even though the kinds of activities that they were promoting and endorsing, I think, certainly were what many folks would consider feminist initiatives, but rather they tried to frame them as service to the nation, service to the state.
And they made a good case, pointing out that Russia had more women engineers than the U.S.
They estimated that in the United States, women engineers hovered around 2% of the engineering population. But they pointed out that women engineers in the Soviet Union represented nearly 30% of the profession.
Today, many women scientists and engineers are still making the same arguments, that women don't just need science and engineering for their own sake, but for the sake of the nation. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quance.
And a blog first started by Purnima Vijayashankar, a founding engineer at Mint, has grown from a creative outlet to a business where she advises and educates people looking to move ahead in the tech field.
Part of, you know, what was going on was there's a certain culture, the tech culture, whether it's in college or whether it's in the workforce, where women especially at times feel like they can't ask for help or they're going to, you know, appear meek if they do. And so part of what I just did was say, hey, you know, I ask for help all the time, or, you know, I invite myself to events, or, you know, here's what I do when I get stuck. And I just kind of kept writing and writing about that on my blog. And then people would reach out and say, oh, well, you know, did you ever have this issue or that issue? And I started to notice some patterns. The first thing was that people, especially women, were coming to me for soft skills. They wanted to know, you know, how do you negotiate? How do you deal with like a tough manager or a tough team? And how do you even get yourself to the next level in terms of your career? And then, of course, the second, being in tech, right, is people were asking me, well, how do you build a product? And it was that question of how do you build a product that I decided I really wanted to focus Femgineer around in a couple different ways. The first was to have some formal education, so to actually teach a course on how do you go about building a product and then commercializing it? But then the second is that the product is really where, you know, both men and women are interested, and that's where the team forms, but that's also where a lot of conflicts happen. And so I wanted to bring in the conversation around how do you craft your soft skills. And I do that not through education, but through some events that I hold on a monthly basis in San Francisco and oftentimes other cities. And so that's how FEM Junior has grown into an education service.
Purnima, I don't know the reality of being a woman engineer these days. You hear the stories that there aren't that many women engineers. It's tough to get into the field. Was that your experience?
What's surprising to me, actually, is in my undergrad, I actually had teams that were 50% men and women. And I didn't feel like there was a huge, you know, dearth of women in the field. It wasn't until I left and got into industry that I noticed that people were dropping out. And so I took a survey of all the women that I knew, and the vast majority were dropping out because they weren't getting promoted, and it wasn't because they lacked technical skills. A lot of these women had advanced degrees, you know, 5 to 10 years of experience, were making major contributions on the team, and just weren't getting recognized. And I saw them leaving because of that, either to pursue, you know, purely motherhood or some combination of motherhood and a more softer skills-based role. And that led me to kind of question what was going on and, you know, inspire me to start FEMGineer to showcase that, hey, you can stay technical and, you know, here are some of the things that you might need to do to kind of push your way through the harder moments.
And it's interesting that what you've been observing is over the past 7 years when we have been in a recession. So what have you seen from women who want to be in the field and in the field itself?
I've actually known about the industry for a very long time, just through dinner table conversations. My dad worked for all of the large tech players in the industry. And what's been interesting that's happened, especially, like you said, in the last 7 years, is there's been a lot of investment dollars that are being put back into the market. And part of it is kind of a series of IPOs that have happened. So the first and sort of the catalyst was Google. And with Google occurring, you know, there were a lot of people that came out of it that wanted to put money back into the system, either, you know, through some pay it forward ideology they had, or just because they wanted to have a better means to invest their capital, right? Because the stock market certainly wasn't going to get it. It wasn't, of course, just Google, because there's, of course, Facebook and most recently Twitter. So there were all these, you know, millionaires that have started to crop up, and they want a place to put their capital. And being in Silicon Valley, they just wholeheartedly believe that they want to put it back into the community that helped them become successful. And so what's happened in the last 7 years is that there's been just a lot of startups. What's been difficult, I think, for a lot of folks to understand is that, you know, both genders want to start companies and both genders want access to capital. But what's happening is that the people that are funding tend to fund those that they feel comfortable funding, either because they see some sort of pattern or there's some sort of bond. You know, they might even be their own friends or colleagues that worked with them before. And it's making it really difficult on women to get access to the same level of capital. And then, of course, the way in which, you know, women present themselves, that's a whole other, you know, topic. One of the things that I was taught from the ripe age of 14 is that as a woman, you have a much higher frequency. And so the way that you're heard is different than the way that men are heard. And it's not anything, you know, of a prejudice. It's just kind of how humans are hardwired, right? If anyone's met me, you know, I'm barely 5'2". And so when you get up on stage, I don't necessarily have the most commanding presence. So there's a lot that has to go into someone seeing me as a larger-than-life figure. And a lot of times, women don't have this kind of coaching. And so as a result, a lot of times, the way in which women communicate results in either being very subtle and along those lines also being indirect or asking questions instead of making statements and making statements that aren't absolute but kind of, you know, leave the room for people to maybe ask further questions. So all of these methods of communication and presenting actually make it seem like women are present themselves as less confident, you know, rather than walking into a room and saying, hey, here's what I think, here's why I deserve to fundraise this much money, and here's why I think my company is going to succeed. They just don't have all of that built in to their system in terms of how they've presented, because one, you know, there aren't a lot of people out there, role models, doing this, but two, they also haven't gone through any sort of formal training. Now, it's not that men have gone through a lot of formal training either, because a lot of men I know haven't, but they have, at least through social pressures and through social conventions, become a lot more comfortable with asserting themselves. And not only asserting themselves in terms of negotiations, but being very clear and direct and to the point. I think the other, which a lot of times people, especially in the startup community and in Silicon Valley, don't realize is, you know, I'm not going to explicitly say that there are boys, old boys clubs or anything like that, but there are men who are actively getting mentorship. And there are women who may or may not be reaching out, but I've noticed that a lot of times they're not forming the same level of bonds that a lot of these younger boys and younger men are. And so then it makes it obviously harder to go out and, you know, raise a lot of capital because they don't have that same level of relationship. Where I've chosen to focus are a couple key areas. So the first is we don't go after trying to get more people into the industry, right? We actually believe that there are a fair number of men and women who are very talented, and we actually want to keep them there. We want to retain the folks who are already there, because too often what happens is, you know, you fill the pipeline with a lot of young minds, but then after a few years, they leave anyways, right? So why bother putting all the effort there? Why not think about keeping people around and making some structural changes? So I'm more focused on solving the retention problem. The second piece is I'm not concerned right now with regards to things like fundraising or access to capital. What I want to focus on is the engineer who's looking to make one of two careers in their lifetime. The first might be someone who says, I want to pursue a very, very technical track, maybe become a VP of engineering or a CTO, or, you know, initially get started as a team lead. The second would be the folks who decide, hey, I'm an engineer, but I actually want to be an entrepreneur. I either want to start a company or I have an idea that I want to commercialize. And so I also help that second group of people who are looking to build their own companies, people who are already in tech, who are looking to level up in their careers, whether that career is inside of a company or they're looking to start their own.
Purnima Vijayashankar is an engineer, lecturer, and co-founder of Femgineer.com. Up next, science and art make beautiful music. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1268. Through the ages, mathematicians have studied music, with the Pythagoreans of ancient Greece maintaining that all nature consists of harmony arising out of numbers. Producer Mia Lobel created this profile of sound artist Susan Alexander, who uses vibrational frequencies from the natural world, from DNA to planetary spins, to create her music.
I got very interested in alternative tunings, and also I wanted to investigate what the rest of the universe was doing according to frequency. So I reasoned with my childlike mind that if things were jiggling and vibrating, they were creating a frequency. And if they were creating a frequency, then couldn't we hear it? It took me some time to realize how to work with this math. But what it came down to is you can take any frequency that's very, very large as long as it's periodic. That is to say, as long as it does the same rotation sort of fairly steadily, like the rotation of a planet. You can take that very slow rotation and you can speed it up until, if it were sound, your ears would be able to pick it up as a tone. And likewise, you can do the same thing. You can take a very fast, high molecular frequency, say something spinning on the molecular level, and you can slow that down, slow it way down so it falls within the range of the ear. Dr. David Diemer, he is a biology teacher, professor at UCSC, very esteemed for his studies on the origin of life. He and I collaborated on a project called Sequentia. He gave me frequencies from nature, from DNA, and I transcribed those into tone. If DNA is creating vibrational frequencies, which it is, and if that could be heard as tone, as sound, what would it sound like? What kinds of relationships would be in there? Would there be octave relationships that would make sense? Would things be in clusters? Would they range over a broad spectrum of tone? Would they sound beautiful? Would they sound ugly? Would they be abrasive? What Dr. Diemer gave me were frequencies on the infrared spectrum that are light frequencies. They're not sound. They're infrared, so they're way faster and higher than we could possibly hear them. But they're fairly steady and they're measurable. They come on spectrographs. You can look at these in books. And then all I need to do is bring them down a number of octaves. And in the case of DNA, they're so fast and high on the infrared spectra that they come down 32 to 35 octaves. That is to say, you take that frequency and you cut it in half, which gives you the octave below, and then you divide it in half again and you get another lower octave, and again, and you keep getting that till you get down to about 5,000 hertz, and then the ear is happy, you can hear it. It turns out that the elements of the periodic table, hydrogen, oxygen, so forth, emit a tone, or a frequency, I should say. It's not yet a tone. It's a frequency, it's a radio wave from the nucleus of their atomic structure called a Larmor frequency that hardly anybody has heard about. So I was very fascinated with these, and I wanted to know how hydrogen, for instance, related to oxygen, or how oxygen related to carbon as a tone. I can get Larmor frequencies in a science library out of a book. So what I get is a number, and it's a very, very, very high number because it's a radio wave frequency, which is way, way, way up there. 10 to 15 octaves higher than our ear could possibly perceive it if it were sound, and it's not sound. But what I can do is I can just divide that number in half and divide it again and again and again till I bring it down about 15 times. And for instance, I don't have in my book the original number for, say, oxygen. But I do have that if I bring that number down 16 octaves, I come out with the number 88.06. So if I look on my tone chart, that number falls between an F and an F sharp on the normal piano. But I don't have a normal piano. I have a Yamaha DX7 keyboard that can give me microtones if I ask for it. The synthesizer can create that precise tone, and it can send it over to my computer so that I can hear exactly 88.06. So I can do that with any of the numbers that I get out of the book. And then I can hear the relationships between all of them and hear what they're doing. And then I can compose with it. Everything is frequency. Everything is a vibration. And, you know, this vibrational world that we're swimming in is so incredibly beautiful. And if people would just listen, it will change your world. You'll never be the same. What inspires me? Oh, gosh. I really want to know how the universe works, and I want to know all the layers of how that universe works. I want to learn, you know, cutting edge, what the scientists are discovering. You know, are there parallel universes? How does time work? And then can I translate that into a sonic medium so that somehow our bodies can recognize that story and go, oh yeah, that's the way it works. To connect in through those pathways as well as through the mind and the ear.
That interview comes to us courtesy producer Mia Lobel. And finally, linking sound and memory. From MIT student program Terrascope Radio, the story of one Indian classical singer, a crowded little apartment in Queens, and the sound that recalls memories leading her through life.
When people make analogies that say that places resonate with music, that's one of those rooms. It's this old little sort of dingy apartment that's located in the Upper East Side of Queens. But in the 26255 building, the 4 East floor, was one Indian family of ours, like family friends, and our music teacher. So she would come there every morning, and all of the Long Island kids, we all carpool from our areas to Queens, and we would get together and have music classes every single day in that one apartment. We often pass by that apartment now. We feel like every time we take a step in the living room, we hear our music teacher like yelling at us or screaming that somebody wasn't on pitch or that the Madangam guy had forgotten to tune or something or other. And every time we go back, we like sing this one song that we always used to start the day with. This particular place, along with a bunch of other sort of scenes in my life or in my musical career up to now, I like to just sort them in a file in my mind called memories. And I know this sounds really weird, but in my opinion, memories are like little toy soldiers. They march with you, and one by one, they get knocked off by life when it gets in the way and stresses you out. Then another one comes right up to take its place and to support you and lead you right through. Whether there was singing going on or not, somehow we always left the shruti running. Shruti is basically a pitch. And that sort of constant diatone drone in the background just like filled any silence that there was. It was kind of white noise at that point. But if I go back to it now, it creates an image, if you know what I mean.
That story comes to us courtesy Terrascope Radio. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.